14. Hodges hangs up and opens Firefox. He types in Z the end and finds himself looking at a cartoon man swinging a cartoon pickaxe. Clouds of dirt fly up, forming the same message over and over. Sorry, we're still under construction, but keep checking back. We are made to persist. That's how we find out who we are. Tobias Wolff. Another idea worthy of Reader's Digest, Hodges thinks, and goes to his window. Morning traffic on Lower Marlboro is moving briskly. He realizes, with wonder and gratitude, that the pain in his side has entirely disappeared for the first time in days. He could almost believe nothing is wrong with him, but the bitter taste in his mouth contradicts that. The bitter taste, he thinks. The residue. His cell rings. It's Norma Wilmer, her voice pitched so low he has to strain to hear. If this is about the so-called visitors list, I haven't had a chance to look for it yet. This place is crawling with police and cheap suits from the district attorney's office. You'd think Hartsfield escaped instead of died. It's not about the list, although I still need that info. And if you can get it to me today, it's worth another $50. Get it to me before noon and I'll make it 100. Jesus, what's the big deal with this? I asked Georgia Frederick. She's been bouncing back and forth between Ortho and the Bucket for the last 10 years. And she says the only person she ever saw visiting Hartsfield besides you was some ratty chick with tattoos and a marine haircut. This rings no bells with Hodges, but there is a faint vibration, which he doesn't trust. He wants to put this thing together too badly, and that means he must step with special care. What do you want, Bill? I'm in a fucking linen closet. It's hot, and I've got a headache. My old partner called and told me Brady swallowed some shit and killed himself. What that says to me is he must have stockpiled enough dope over time to do it. Is that possible? It is. It's also possible I could land a 767 jumbo jet if the whole flight crew died of food poisoning, but both things are very fucking unlikely. I'll tell you what I told the cops and the two most annoying yappers from the DA's office. Brady got Anaprox DS on PE days, one pill with food before, one late in the day if he asked, which he rarely did. Anaprox isn't really much more powerful when it comes to controlling pain than Advil, which you can buy OTC. He also had extra-strength Tylenol on his chart, but only asked for it on a few occasions. How did the DA guys react to that? Right now, they're operating under the theory that he swallowed a shitload of Anaprox. But you don't buy it? Of course I don't! Where would he hide that many pills? Up his bony bedsword ass? I have to go. I'll get back to you on the visitors list, if there ever was one, that is. Thank you, Norma. Try some Anaprox for that headache of yours. Fuck you, Bill. But she says it with a laugh. 15. The first thought to cross Hodges' mind when Jerome walks in is, holy shit, kiddo, you grew up. When Jerome Robinson came to work for him, first as a kid who cut his grass, then as an all-around handyman, finally as the tech angel who kept his computer up and running, he was a weedy teenager, going about 5'8 and 140 pounds. The young giant in the doorway is 6'2 if he's an inch, and at least 190. He was always good-looking, but now he's movie star good-looking and all muscled out. The subject in question breaks into a grin, strides quickly across the office, and embraces Hodges. He squeezes, but lets go in a hurry when he sees Hodges wince.
Jesus, sorry.
You didn't hurt me. Just happy to see you, my man. His vision is a little blurry, and he wipes at his eyes with the heel of his hand. You're a sight for sore eyes.
You too. How you feeling?
Right now, good. I've got pills for pain, but you're better medicine.
Holly is standing in the doorway, sensible winter coat unzipped, small hands linked at her waist. She's watching them with an unhappy smile. Hodges wouldn't have believed there was such a thing, but apparently there is.
Come on over, Holly, he says. No group hug, I promise. Have you filled Jerome in on this business?
He knows about Barbara's part, but I thought I'd better let you tell the rest.
Jerome briefly cups the back of Hodges' neck with a big warm hand. Holly says you're going into the hospital tomorrow for for more tests and a treatment plan. And if you try to argue, I'm supposed to tell you to shut up.
Not shut up, Holly says, looking at Jerome severely. I never use that phrase.
Jerome grins. You had be quiet on your lips, but shut up in your eyes.
Fool,
she says, but the smile returns. Happy we're together, Hodges thinks, sad because of the reason why. He breaks up this strangely pleasant sibling rivalry by asking how Barbara is. Okay. Fractures of the tibia and fibula, mid-shaft. Could have happened on the soccer field or skiing on a bunny slope. Supposed to heal with no problem. She's got a cast and is already complaining about how it itches underneath. Mom went out to get her a scratcher thing. Holly, did you show her the six-pack?
I did, and she picked out Dr. Babineau. Never even hesitated.
I have a few questions for you, Doc, Hodges thinks, and I intend to get some answers before my last day is over. If I have to squeeze you to get them, make your eyes pop out a little, that will be just fine. Jerome settles on one corner of Hodges' desk, his usual perch.
Run through the whole thing for me, from the beginning. I might see something new.
Hodges does most of the talking. Holly goes to the window and looks out on Lower Marlborough, arms crossed, hands cupping her shoulders. She adds something from time to time, but mostly she just listens. When Hodges is done, Jerome asks,
How sure are you about this mind over matter thing?
Hodges considers, 80%, maybe more. It's wild, but there are too many stories to discount it.
If he could do it, it's my fault. Holly says without turning from the window. When I hit him with your happy slapper, Bill, it could have rearranged his brain somehow, given him access to the 90% of gray matter we never use.
Maybe, Hodges says, but if you hadn't clobbered him, you and Jerome would be dead.
Along with a lot of other people, Jerome says, and the hit might not have had anything to do with it. Whatever Babineau was feeding him could have done more than bring him out of his coma. Experimental drugs sometimes have unexpected effects, you know.
Or it could have been a combination of the two, Hodges says. He can't believe they're having this conversation. But not to have it would fly in the face of Rule 1 in the detective biz. You go where the facts lead you.
He hated you, Bill, Jerome says. Instead of killing yourself, which is what he wanted, you came after him.
And turned his own weapon against him,
Holly adds, still without turning and still hugging herself.
You used Debbie's blue umbrella to force him into the open. It was him who sent you that message 2 nights ago. I know it was Brady Hartsfield calling himself Z-Boy.
Now she turns.
It's as plain as the nose on your face. You stopped him at the Mingo.
No, I was downstairs having a heart attack. You were the one who stopped him, Holly.
She shakes her head fiercely. He doesn't know that because he never saw me. Do you think I could forget what happened that night? I'll never forget it. Barbara was sitting across the aisle, a few rows up, and it was her he was looking at, not me. I shouted something at him and hit him as soon as he started to turn his head. Then I hit him again. Oh, God, I hit him so hard.
Jerome starts toward her, but she motions him back. Eye contact is hard for her, but now she's looking straight at Hodges, and her eyes are blazing.
You goaded him out into the open. You were the one who figured out his password so we could crack his computer and find out what he was going to do. You were the one he always blamed. I know that. And then you kept going to his room, sitting there and talking to him.
And you think that's why he did this, whatever this is?
No, she nearly shrieks it. He did it because he was fracking crazy.
There's a pause. And then, in a meek voice, she says she's sorry for raising her voice.
Don't apologize, Holly Berry, Jerome says. You thrill me when you're masterful.
She makes a face at him. Jerome snorts a laugh and asks Hodges about Dinah Scott Zappett.
I'd like a look at it.
My coat pocket, Hodges says, but watch out for the fishing hole demo. Jerome rummages in Hodges' coat, rejects a roll of Tums and the ever-present detective's notebook, and brings out Dinah's green Zappit.
Holy Joe! I thought these things went out with VCRs and dial-up modems.
They pretty much did,
Holly says.
And the price didn't help. I checked. $189, suggested retail, back in 2012. Ridiculous.
Jerome tosses the Zappit from hand to hand. His face is grim, and he looks tired.
Well, sure, Hodges thinks. He was building houses in Arizona yesterday. Had to rush home because his normally cheerful sister tried to kill herself. Maybe Jerome sees some of this on Hodges' face.
Barb's leg will be fine. It's her mind I'm a little worried about. She talks about blue flashes and a voice she heard coming from the game.
She says it's still in her head, Holly adds, like some piece of music that turns into an earworm. It will probably pass in time now that her game is broken. But what about the others who got the consoles?
With the bad concert website down, is there any way of finding out how many others did?
Holly and Jerome look at each other, then give identical head shakes.
Shit, Hodges says. I mean, I'm not all that surprised, but still, shit.
Does this one give out blue flashes?
Jerome still hasn't turned the Zappit on, just keeps playing hot potato with it. Nope, and the pink fish don't turn into numbers. Try it for yourself.
Instead of doing that, Jerome turns it over and opens the battery compartment. Plain old double A's, he says. The rechargeable kind. No magic there. But the fishing hole demo really makes you sleepy?
It did me, Hodges says. He does not add that he was medicated up the wazoo at the time. Right now, I'm more interested in Babineau. He's part of this. I don't understand how that partnership came about, but if he's still alive, he's going to tell us. And there's someone else involved, too.
The man the housekeeper saw, Holly says. The one who drives an old car with the primer spots. Do you want to know what I think?
Hit me.
One of them, either Dr. Babineau or the man with the old car, paid a visit to the nurse, Ruth Scapelli. Hartsfield must have had something against her.
How could he send anyone anywhere? Jerome asks, sliding the battery cover back into place with a click.
Mind control? According to you, Bill, the most he could do with his tele-what's-this was turn on the water in his bathroom, and it's hard for me to accept even that. It could be just so much talk, a hospital legend instead of an urban one.
It has to be the games, Hodges muses. He did something to the games, amped them up somehow.
From his hospital room? Jerome gives him a look that says, be serious.
I know, it doesn't make sense, not even if you add in the telekinesis. But it has to be the games. Has to be.
Babineau will know, Holly says.
She's a poet and don't know it, Jerome says moodily. He's still tossing the console back and forth.
Hodges has a feeling that he's resisting an impulse to throw it on the floor and stomp on it, and that's sort of reasonable. After all, one just like it almost got his sister killed. No, Hodges thinks. Not just like it. The fishing hole demo on Dinah's Zappit generates a mild hypnotic effect, but nothing else. And it's probably... He straightens suddenly, provoking a twinge of pain in his side. Holly, have you searched for fishing hole info on the net?
No, she says. I never thought of it.
Would you do it now? What I want to know...
If there's chatter about the demo screen. I should have thought of that myself. I'll do it now. She hurries into the outer office.
What I don't understand, Hodges says, is why Brady would kill himself before seeing how it all came out.
You mean before seeing how many kids he could get to off themselves, Jerome says. Kids who were at that fucking concert. Because that's what we're talking about, isn't it?
Yeah, Hodges says. There are too many blank spots, Jerome. Far too many. I don't even know how he killed himself, if he actually did.
Jerome presses the heels of his hands to his temples as if to keep his brain from swelling.
Please don't tell me you think he's still alive.
No, he's dead, all right. Pete wouldn't make a mistake about that. What I'm saying is maybe somebody murdered him. Based on what we know, Babineau would be the prime suspect.
Holy poop!
Holly cries from the other room. Hodges and Jerome happen to be looking at each other when she says it, and there is a moment of divine harmony as they both struggle against laughter.
What? Hodges calls. It's all he can manage without bursting into mad brays of hilarity which would hurt his side as well as Holly's feelings.
I found a site called Fishing Hole Hypnosis. The start page warns parents not to let their kids look at the demo screen too long. It was first noticed in the arcade game version back in 2005. The Game Boy fixed it, but the Zap-It... Wait a sec. They said they did, but they didn't. There's a whole big, long thread.
Hodges looks at Jerome.
She means an online conversation, Jerome says.
A kid in Des Moines passed out, hit his head on the edge of his desk, and fractured his skull.
She sounds almost gleeful as she gets up and rushes back to them. Her cheeks are flushed and rosy.
There would have been lawsuits. I bet that's one of the reasons the Zap-It company went out of business. It might even have been one of the reasons why Sunrise Solutions...
The phone on her desk begins to ring.
Oh, frack, she says, turning toward it.
Tell whoever it is that we're closed today. But after saying hello, you've reached Finders Keepers, Holly just listens. Then she turns, holding out the handset.
It's Pete Huntley. He says he has to talk to you right away, and he sounds funny, like he's sad or mad or something.
Hodges goes into the outer office to find out what's got Pete sounding sad or mad or something. Behind him, Jerome finally powers up Dinah Scott Zap-It.
In Freddie Linkletter's computer nest, Freddie herself has taken 4 Excedrin and gone to sleep in her bedroom. 44 found changes to 45 found. The repeater flashes loading. Then it flashes task complete.
16. Pete doesn't say hello. What he says is, take it, Kerm. Take it and beat it until the truth falls out. Bitch is in the house with a couple of skids and I'm out back in a, whatever it is, potting shed, I think, and it's cold as hell.
Hodges is at first too surprised to answer, and not because a pair of skids, the city cop's acronym for State Criminal Investigation Division Detectives, is on some scene Pete is working. He's surprised, in truth almost flabbergasted, because in all their long association, he's only heard Pete use the B-word in connection with an actual woman a single time. That was when speaking of his mother-in-law, who urged Pete's wife to leave and took her in, along with the children, when she finally did. The bitch he's talking about this time can only be his partner, a.k.a. Miss Pretty Gray Eyes.
Kermit, are you there?
I'm here, Hodges says. Where are you?
Sugar Heights. Dr. Felix Babineau's house on Scenic Lilac Drive.
Hell, his fucking estate. You know who Babineau is. I know you do.
No one kept closer tabs on Brady Hartsfield than you. For a while there, he was your fucking hobby.
Who you're talking about, yes. What you're talking about, no.
This whole thing is going to blow up, partner. And Izzy doesn't want to get hit with the shrapnel when it does. She's got ambitions, see? Chief of detectives in 10 years, maybe chief of police in 15. I get it, but that doesn't mean I like it.
She called Chief Horgan behind my back, and Horgan called the skids. If it's not officially their case now, it will be by noon. They've got their perp, but the shit's not right. I know it, and Izzy does too. She just doesn't give a rat's ass.
You need to slow down, Pete. Tell me what's going on.
Holly is hovering anxiously. Hodges shrugs his shoulders and raises a finger. Wait.
Housekeeper gets here at 7:30, okay? Nora Everly, by name. And at the top of the drive, she sees Babineau's BMW on the lawn, with a bullet hole in the windshield. She looks inside, sees blood on the steering wheel and the seat, calls 911. There's a cop car 5 minutes away. In the Heights, there's always one 5 minutes away. And when it arrives, Everly's sitting in her car with all the doors locked, shaking like a leaf. The unis tell her to stay put and go to the door. The place is unlocked. Mrs. Babineau, Cora, is lying dead in the hall, and I'm sure the bullet the ME digs out of her will match the one forensics dug out of the Beamer. On her forehead, are you ready for this? There's the letter Z in black ink. More all around the downstairs, including one on the TV screen, just like the one at the Ellerton place. And I think it was right about then my partner decided she wanted no part of this particular tar baby.
Hodges says, yeah, probably, just to keep Pete talking. He grabs the pad beside Holly's computer and prints Babineau's wife murdered in big black letters, like a newspaper headline. Her hand flies to her mouth.
While one of the cops is calling division, the other one hears snores coming from upstairs.
like a chainsaw on idle, he said. So they go up, guns drawn, and in one of the three guest bedrooms, count 'em, three, the place is fucking huge, they find an old fart fast asleep. They wake him up, and he gives his name as Alvin Brooks.
Library Al, Hodges shouts, from the hospital. The first Zappit I ever saw was one he showed me.
Yeah, that's the guy. He had a Kiner ID badge in his shirt pocket, and without prompting, he says he killed Mrs. Babineau. Claims he did it while he was hypnotized. So they cuff him, take him downstairs, and sit him on the couch. That's where Izzy and me found him when we entered the scene half an hour or so later. I don't know what's wrong with the guy, whether he had a nervous breakdown or what, but he's on Planet Purple. He keeps going off on tangents, spouting all sorts of weird shit.
Hodges recollects something Al said to him on one of his last visits to Brady's room, right around Labor Day weekend of 2014, that would have been. Never so good as what you don't see.
Yeah, Pete sounds surprised. Like that. And when Izzy asked who hypnotized him, he said it was the fish. The ones by the beautiful sea.
To Hodges, this now makes sense.
On further questioning, I did it. By then, Izzy must have been in the kitchen, busy ditching the whole thing without asking for my input. He said Dr. Z told him to, I quote, make his mark. 10 times, he said. And sure enough, there are 10 Zs, including the one on the deceased forehead. I asked him if Dr. Z was Dr. Babineau, and he said no, Dr. Z was Brady Hartsfield. Crazy, see?
Yeah, Hodges says.
I asked him if he shot Dr. Babineau, too. He just shook his head and said he wanted to go back to sleep. Right around then, Izzy comes tripping back from the kitchen and says Chief Horgan called the skids on account of Dr. B is a high-profile guy, and this is going to be a high-profile case, and besides, a pair of them happen to be right here in the city waiting to be called to testify in a case. Isn't that convenient? She won't meet my eye. She's all flushed. And when I start pointing around at all the Z's, asking her if they don't look familiar, she won't talk about it.
Hodges has never heard such anger and frustration in his old partner's voice.
So then my cell rings, and you remember when I reached out to you this morning, I said that Doc on Call took a sample of the residue in Hartsfield's mouth before the ME guy even got there?
Yeah.
Well, the phone call was from that doc. Simonson, his name is. The ME's analysis won't be back for 2 days at the soonest, but Simonson did one right away. The stuff in Hartsfield's mouth was a combination of Vicodin and Ambien. Hartsfield wasn't prescribed either one, and he could hardly dance his way down to the nearest med locker and score some, could he?
Hodges, who already knows what Brady was taking for pain, agrees that that would be unlikely.
Right now, Izzy's in the house, probably watching them from the background and keeping her mouth shut while the skids question this Brooks guy who, honest to God, can't remember his own name unless he's prompted. Otherwise, he calls himself Z-Boy, like something out of a Marvel comic book.
Clutching the pen in his hand almost hard enough to snap it in two, Hodges prints more headline caps on the pad with Holly bending over to read as he writes, Library Al left the message on Debbie's blue umbrella. Holly stares at him with wide eyes.
Just before the skids arrived, man, they didn't take long, I asked Brooks if he also killed Brady Hartsfield. Izzy says to him, don't answer that.
She said what? Hodges exclaims. He doesn't have much room in his head right now to worry about Pete's deteriorating relationship with his partner, but he's still amazed. Izzy's a police detective, after all, not Library Al's defense attorney.
You heard me. Then she looks at me and says, you haven't given him the words. So I turn to one of the uniforms and ask, did you guys Mirandize this gentleman? And of course they say, yeah. I look at Izzy, and she's redder in the face than ever. But she won't back down. She says, if we fuck this up, it won't come back on you. You're done in another couple of weeks, but it'll come back on me. And hard.
So the state boys turn up.
Yeah. And now I'm out here in the late Mrs. Babineau's potting shed, or whatever the fuck it is, freezing my ass off. The richest part of the city, Kerm, and I'm in a shack colder than a well digger's belt buckle. I bet Izzy knows I'm calling you, too. Tattling to my dear old Uncle Kermit.
Pete is probably right about that. But if Miss Pretty Gray Eyes is as set on climbing the ladder as Pete believes, she's probably thinking of an uglier word. Snitching.
This Brooks guy is out of whatever little mind he's got left, which makes him the perfect donkey to pin the tail on when this hits the media. You know how they're going to lay it out?
Hodges does, but lets Pete say it.
Brooks got it in his head that he was some avenger of justice called Z-Boy. He came here, he killed Mrs. Babineau when she opened the door, then killed the doc himself when Babineau got in his beamer and tried to flee. Brooks then drove to the hospital and fed Hartsfield a bunch of pills from the Babineau's private stash. I don't doubt that part, because they had a fucking pharmacy in their medicine cabinet. And sure, he could have gotten up to the brain injury clinic without any problem. He's got an ID card, and he's been a hospital fixture for the last 6 or 7 years. But why? And what did he do with Babineau's body? Because it's not here.
Good question. Pete plunges on.
They'll say Brooks loaded it into his own car and ditched it somewhere, probably in a ravine or a culvert, and probably when he was coming back from feeding Hartsfield those pills. But why do that when he left the woman's body lying right there in the hall? And why come back here in the first place?
They'll say,
yeah, that he's crazy. Sure they will. Perfect answer for anything that doesn't make sense. And if Ellerton and Stover come up at all, which they probably won't, they'll say he killed them too.
If they do, Hodges thinks, Nancy Alderson will backstop the story, at least to a degree, because it was undoubtedly Library Al that she saw watching the house on Hilltop Court.
They'll hang Brooks out to dry, wade through the press coverage and call it good. But there's more to it, Kerm. Gotta be. If you know anything, if you've got even a single thread to pull, pull it. Promise me you will.
I have more than one, Hodges thinks. But Babineau's the key, and Babineau has disappeared. How much blood was in the car, Pete?
Not a lot, but forensics has already confirmed it's Babineau's type. That's not conclusive, but...
Shit, I gotta go. Izzy and one of the skid guys just came out the back door. They're looking for me.
All right.
Call me, and if you need anything I can access, let me know.
I will.
Hodges ends the call and looks up, wanting to fill Holly in. But Holly is no longer beside him.
Bill, her voice is low, come in here. Puzzled, he walks to the door of his office, where he stops dead.
Jerome is behind the desk, sitting in Hodges' swivel chair. His long legs are splayed out, and he's looking at Dinah Scott Zappit. His eyes are wide open, but empty. His mouth hangs ajar. There are fine drops of spittle on his lower lip. A tune is tinkling from the gadget's tiny speaker, but not the same tune as last night. Hodges is sure of it.
Jerome?
He takes a step forward, but before he can take another, Holly grabs him by the belt. Her grip is surprisingly strong.
No, she says in the same low voice. You shouldn't startle him. Not when he's like that.
What then?
I had a year of hypnotherapy when I was in my 30s. I was having problems with... Well, never mind what I was having problems with. Let me try.
Are you sure? She looks at him, her face now pale, her eyes fearful.
No, but we can't leave him like that. Not after what happened to Barbara.
The Zappit in Jerome's limp hands gives off a bright blue flash. Jerome doesn't react, doesn't blink. Only continues staring at the screen while the music tinkles. Holly takes a step forward, then another.
Jerome.
No answer.
Jerome, can you hear me?
Yes, Jerome says, not looking up from the screen.
Jerome, where are you?
And Jerome says,
at my funeral. Everyone is there. It's beautiful.
17. Brady became fascinated with suicide at the age of 12 while reading Raven, a true crime book about the mass suicides in Jonestown, Guyana. There, more than 900 people, a third of them children, died after drinking fruit juice laced with cyanide. What interested Brady aside from the thrillingly high body count, was the lead-up to the final orgy. Long before the day when whole families swallowed the poison together and nurses, actual nurses, used hypodermics to squirt death down the throats of squalling infants, Jim Jones was preparing his followers for their apotheosis with fiery sermons and suicide rehearsals he called White Nights. He first filled them with paranoia, then hypnotized them with the glamour of death. As a senior, Brady wrote his only A paper for a half-assed sociology class called American Life. The paper was called American Deathways, a brief study of suicide in the U.S. In it, he cited the statistics for 1999, then the most recent year for which they were available. More than 40,000 people had killed themselves during that year, usually with guns, the most reliable go-to method, but with pills running a close second. They also hung themselves, drowned themselves, bled out, stuck their heads in gas ovens, set themselves on fire, and rammed their cars into bridge abutments. One inventive fellow, this Brady did not put into his report, even then he was careful not to be branded an oddity, stuck a 220-volt line up his rectum and electrocuted himself. In 1999, suicide was the 10th leading cause of death in America, and if you added in the ones that were reported as accidents or natural causes, it would undoubtedly be right up there with heart disease, cancer, and car crashes, most likely still behind them, but not far behind. Brady quoted Albert Camus, who said, "There is but one truly serious philosophical problem, and that is suicide." He also quoted a famous psychiatrist named Raymond Katz, who stated flatly, "Every human being is born with a suicide gene." Brady did not bother to add the second part of Katz's statement because he felt it took some of the drama out of it. In most of us, it remains dormant. In the 10 years between his graduation from high school and that disabling moment in the Mingo Auditorium, Brady's fascination with suicide, including his own, always seen as part of some grand and historic gesture, continued. This seed has now, against all the odds, fully blossomed. He will be the Jim Jones of the 21st century. 18. 40 miles north of the city, he can wait no longer. Brady pulls into a rest area on I-47, kills the laboring engine of Z-Boy's Malibu, and powers up Babineau's laptop. There's no Wi-Fi here, as there is at some rest areas, but thanks to Big Mama Verizon, there's a cell tower not 4 miles away, standing tall against the thickening clouds. Using Babineau's MacBook Air, he can go anywhere he wants and never have to leave this nearly deserted parking lot. He thinks, and not for the first time, that a touch of telekinesis is nothing compared to the power of the internet. He's sure thousands of suicides have incubated in the potent soup of its social media sites, where the trolls run free and the bullying goes on endlessly. That's real mind over matter. He's not able to type as fast as he'd like to. The damp air pushing in with the coming storm has worsened the arthritis in Babineau's fingers, but eventually the laptop is mated to the high-powered gear back in Freddie Linklater's computer room. He won't have to stay mated to it for long. He clicks on a hidden file he placed on the laptop during one of his previous visits inside Babineau's head. Open link to Z the end? Y, N. He centers the cursor on Y, hits the return key, then waits. The worry circle goes around and around and around. Just as he's begun to wonder if something has gone wrong, the laptop flashes the message he's been waiting for. Z the end is now active. Good. Z the end is just a little icing on the cake. He has been able to disseminate only a limited number of Zap-Its, and a significant portion of his shipment was defective, for Christ's sake. But teenagers are herd creatures, and herd creatures are in mental and emotional lockstep. It's why fish school and bees swarm. It's why the swallows come back each year to Capistrano. In human behavior, It's why the wave goes around at football and baseball stadiums, and why individuals will lose themselves in a crowd simply because the crowd is there. Teenage boys have a tendency to wear the same baggy shorts and grow the same scruff on their faces, lest they be excluded from the herd. Teenage girls adopt the same styles of dress and go crazy for the same musical groups. It's "We Are Your Brothers" this year. Not so long ago it was "Round Here" and "One Direction." Back in the day it was "New Kids on the Block." Fads sweep through teenagers like a measles epidemic, and from time to time, one of those fads is suicide. In southern Wales, dozens of teens hung themselves between 2007 and 2009 with messages on social networking sites stoking the craze. Even the goodbyes they left were couched in net speak, "Me too," and "See you later." Wildfires vast enough to burn millions of acres can be started by a single match thrown into dry brush. The zappets Brady has distributed through his human drones are hundreds of matches. Not all of them will light, and some of those that do won't stay lit. Brady knows this, but he has ztheend.com to serve as both backstop and accelerant. Will it work? He's far from sure. But time is too short for extensive tests. And if it does? Teen suicides all over the state. Maybe all over the Midwest. Hundreds. Perhaps thousands. How would you like that, ex-Detective Hodges? Would that improve your retirement, you meddlesome old fuck? He swaps Babineau's laptop for Z-Boy's game console. It's fitting to use this one. He thinks of it as Zappit Zero, because it's the first one he ever saw, on the day Al Brooks brought it into his room, thinking Brady might like it, which he did. Oh yes, very much. The extra program, with the number fish and the subliminal messages, hasn't been added to this one, because Brady doesn't need it. Those things are strictly for the targets. He watches the fish swim back and forth, using them to settle and focus, then closes his eyes. At first there's only darkness, but after a few moments, red lights begin to appear. More than 50 now. They are like dots on a computer map, except they don't remain stationary. They swim back and forth, left to right, up and down, crisscrossing. He settles on one at random, his eyes rolling beneath his closed lids as he follows its progress. It begins to slow and slow and slow. It stills, then starts growing bigger. It opens like a flower. He's in a bedroom. There's a girl staring fixedly down at the fish on her own Zappit, which she received free from badconcert.com. She's in her bed, because she didn't go to school today. Maybe she said she was sick. "What's your name?" Brady asks. Sometimes they just hear a voice coming from the game console. But the ones who are most susceptible actually see him, like some kind of avatar in a video game. This girl is one of the latter, an auspicious beginning. But they always respond better to their names, so he'll keep saying it. She looks without surprise at the young man sitting beside her on the bed. Her face is pale. Her eyes are dazed. "I'm Ellen," she says. "I'm looking for the right numbers." "Of course you are," he thinks, and slips into her. She's 40 miles south of him, but once the demo screen has opened them, distance doesn't matter. He could control her, turn her into one of his drones, but he doesn't want to do that any more than he wanted to slip into Mrs. Trelawney's house some dark night and cut her throat. Murder isn't control. Murder is just murder. Suicide is control. "Are you happy, Ellen?" "I used to be," she says. "I could be again if I find the right numbers." Brady gives her a smile that's both sad and charming. "Yes, but the numbers are like life. he says. Nothing adds up, Ellen. Isn't that true?
Uh-huh.
Tell me something, Ellen. What are you worried about? He could find it himself, but it will be better if she tells him. He knows there's something, because everyone worries, and teenagers worry most of all.
Right now? The SAT.
Aha, he thinks. The infamous Scholastic Assessment Test, where the Department of Academic Husbandry separates the sheep from the goats.
I'm so bad at math, she says. I reek.
Bad at the numbers, he says, nodding sympathetically.
If I don't score at least 650, I won't get into a good school.
And you'll be lucky to score 400, he says. Isn't that the truth, Ellen?
Yes.
Tears well in her eyes and begin to roll down her cheeks. And then you'll do badly on the English, too, Brady says. He's opening her up, and this is the best part. It's like reaching into an animal that's stunned, but still alive, and digging its guts out. You'll freeze up.
I'll probably freeze up,
Ellen says. She's sobbing audibly now. Brady checks her short-term memory and finds that her parents have gone to work and her little brother is at school, so crying is all right. Let the bitch make all the noise she wants. Not probably. You will freeze up, Ellen, because you can't handle the pressure. She sobs. Say it, Ellen.
I can't handle the pressure. I'll freeze. And if I don't get into a good school, my dad will be disappointed and my mother will be mad.
What if you can't get into any school? What if the only job you can get is cleaning houses or folding clothes in a laundromat?
My mother will hate me.
She hates you already, doesn't she, Ellen?
I don't think...
Yes, she does. She hates you. Say it, Ellen. Say, my mother hates me.
My mother hates me. Oh, God. I'm so scared, and my life is so awful.
This is the great gift bestowed by a combination of Zapit-induced hypnosis and Brady's own ability to invade minds once they are in that open and suggestible state. Ordinary fears, the ones kids like this live with as a kind of unpleasant background noise, can be turned into ravening monsters. Small balloons of paranoia can be inflated until they are as big as floats in the Macy's Thanksgiving Day Parade. You could stop being scared, Brady says, and you could make your mother very, very sorry. Ellen smiles through her tears. You could leave all this behind.
I could. I could leave it behind.
You could be at peace.
Peace,
she says, and sighs. How wonderful this is. It took weeks with Martine Stover's mother, who was always leaving the demo screen to play her goddamn solitaire, and days with Barbara Robinson. With Ruth Scapelli and this pimple-faced crybaby in her poofy pink girl's bedroom? Mere minutes. But then, Brady thinks, I always had a steep learning curve. Do you have your phone, Ellen?
Here.
She reaches under a decorative throw pillow. Her phone is also poofy pink. You should post on Facebook and Twitter, so all your friends can read it.
What should I post?
Say, I am at peace now. You can be too. Go to ztheend.com. She does it, but at an oozingly slow speed. When they're in this state, it's like they're underwater. Brady reminds himself of how well this is going and tries not to become impatient. When she's done and the messages are sent, more matches flicked into dry tinder, he suggests that she go to the window. I think you could use some fresh air. It might clear your head.
I could use some fresh air,
she says, throwing back the duvet and swinging her bare feet out of bed. Don't forget your Zapit, he says. She takes it and walks to the window. Before you open the window, Go to the main screen, where the icons are. Can you do that, Ellen?
Yes.
A long pause. The bitch is slower than cold molasses.
Okay, I see the icons.
Great. Now go to Wipe Words. It's the blackboard and eraser icon.
I see it.
Tap it twice, Ellen. She does so, and the Zap-It gives an acknowledging blue flash. If anyone tries to use this particular game console again, it will give a final blue flash and drop dead.
Now, you can open the window.
Cold air rushes in, blowing her hair back. She wavers, seems on the edge of waking, and for a moment, Brady feels her slipping away. Control is still hard to maintain at a distance, even when they're in a hypnotic state, but he's sure he'll hone his technique to a nice sharp point. Practice makes perfect.
Jump, Brady whispers. Jump, and you won't have to take the SAT. Your mother won't hate you. She'll be sorry. Jump, and all the numbers will come right. You'll get the best prize. The prize is sleep.
The prize is sleep,
Ellen agrees. Do it now, Brady murmurs as he sits behind the wheel of Al Brooks' old car with his eyes closed. 40 miles south, Ellen jumps from her bedroom window. It's not a long drop, and there's banked snow against the house. It's old and crusty, but it still cushions her fall to a degree, so instead of dying, she only breaks a collarbone and 3 ribs. She begins to scream in pain, and Brady is blown out of her head like a pilot strapped to an F-111 ejection seat. Shit! He screams and pounds the steering wheel. Babineau's arthritis flares all the way up his arm, and that makes him angrier still. Shit! Shit! Shit!
19. In the pleasantly upscale neighborhood of Branson Park, Ellen Murphy struggles to her feet. The last thing she remembers is telling her mother she was too sick to go to school. A lie so she could tap pink fish and hunt for prizes on the pleasantly addictive fishing hole demo. Her Zap-It is lying nearby, the screen cracked. It no longer interests her. She leaves it and begins staggering toward the front door on bare feet. Each breath she takes is a stab in the side.
But I'm alive, she thinks. At least I'm alive. What was I thinking? What in God's name was I thinking?
Brady's voice is still with her. The slimy taste of something awful that she swallowed while it was still alive.
20.
Jerome,
Holly asks,
can you still hear me?
Yes.
I want you to turn off the Zap-It and put it on Bill's desk.
And then, because she's always been a belt and suspenders kind of girl, she adds,
face down.
A frown creases his broad brow. Do I have to?
Yes, right now, and without looking at the damn thing.
Before Jerome can follow this order, Hodges catches one final glimpse of the fish swimming and one more bright blue flash. A momentary dizziness, perhaps caused by his pain pills, perhaps not, sweeps through him. Then Jerome pushes the button on top of the console, and the fish disappear. What Hodges feels isn't relief, but disappointment. Maybe that's crazy, but given his current medical problem, maybe it's not. He's seen hypnosis used from time to time to help witnesses achieve better recall, but has never grasped its full power until now. He has an idea, probably blasphemous in this situation, that the Zap-It fish might be better medicine for pain than the stuff Dr. Stamos prescribed.
Holly says, I'm going to count down from 10 to 1, Jerome. Each time you hear a number, you'll be a little more awake, okay?
For several seconds, Jerome says nothing. He sits calmly, peacefully, touring some other reality
and perhaps trying to decide if he would like to live there permanently. Holly, on the other hand, is vibrating like a tuning fork, and Hodges can feel his fingernails biting into his palms as he clenches his fists. At last, Jerome says,
"Okay, I guess, since it's you, Holly Berry."
"Here we go. 10, 9, 8. You're coming back. 7, 6, 5. Waking up."
Jerome raises his head. His eyes are aimed at Hodges, but Hodges isn't sure the boy is seeing him.
4, 3, almost there. 2, 1,
wake up! She claps her hands together. Jerome gives a hard jerk. One hand brushes Dinah's zappet and knocks it to the floor. Jerome looks at Holly with an expression of surprise so exaggerated it would be funny under other circumstances.
"What just happened? Did I go to sleep?"
Holly collapses into the chair ordinarily reserved for clients. She takes a deep breath and wipes her cheeks, which are damp with sweat. "In a way," Hodges says, "the game hypnotized you, like it hypnotized your sister."
"Are you sure?"
Jerome asks, then looks at his watch.
"I guess you are. I just lost 15 minutes.
"Closer to 20. What do you remember?"
"Tapping the pink fish and turning them into numbers. It's surprisingly hard to do. You have to watch closely, really concentrate, and the blue flashes don't help."
Hodges picks the zappet up off the floor.
"I wouldn't turn that on,"
Holly says sharply. "Not going to. But I did last night, and I can tell you there were no blue flashes, and you could tap pink fish until your finger went numb without getting any numbers. Also, the tune is different now. Not much, but a little."
Holly sings, pitch perfect. "By the sea, by the sea, by the beautiful sea, you and me, you and me, oh, how happy we'll be." My mother used to sing it to me when I was little.
Jerome is staring at her with more intensity than she can deal with, and she looks away flustered.
"What? What is it?"
"There were words," he says, "but not those." Hodges heard no words, only the tune, but doesn't say so. Holly asks Jerome if he can remember them. His pitch isn't as good as hers, but it's close enough for them to be sure that, yes, it's the tune they heard.
"You can sleep, you can sleep, it's a beautiful sleep."
He stops. "That's all I can remember. If I'm not just making it up, that is." Holly says,
"Now we know for sure. Someone amped the fishing hole screen."
"Shot it full of roids," Jerome adds. "What does that even mean?" Hodges asks. Jerome nods to Holly, and she says,
"Someone loaded a stealth program into the demo, which is mildly hypnotic to begin with. The program was dormant when Dinah had the zappet, and still dormant when you looked at it last night, Bill, which was lucky for you. But someone turned it on after that."
"Babineau?"
"Him or someone else. If the police are right and Babineau is dead."
"It could have been a preset," Jerome says to Holly, then to Hodges. "You know, like an alarm clock."
"Let me get this straight," Hodges says. "The program was in there all along and only became active once Dinah's zappet was turned on today?"
"Yes," Holly says. "There's probably a repeater at work, don't you think, Jerome?"
"Yeah, a computer program that pumps out the update constantly, waiting for some schlub, me in this case, to turn on a zappet and activate the Wi-Fi."
"This could happen with all of them?"
"If the stealth program is in all of them, sure," Jerome says.
"Brady set this up." Hodges begins to pace, hand going to his side as if to contain the pain and hold it in. "Brady fucking Hartsfield."
"How?"
Holly asks. "I don't know, but it's the only thing that fits. He tries to blow up the Mingo during that concert. We stop him. The audience, most of them young girls, is saved."
"By you, Holly," Jerome says.
"Be quiet, Jerome. Let him tell it."
Her eyes suggest she knows where Hodges is going.
6 years pass. Those young girls, most of them in elementary or middle school in 2010, are in high school, maybe in college. Around here, it's long gone, and the girls are young women now. They've moved on to other kinds of music, but then they get an offer they can't refuse. A free game console. And all they have to do is be able to prove they were at the Round Here show that night. The console probably looks as out of date to them as a black and white TV, but what the hell, it's free.
Yes, Holly says. Brady was still after them. This is his revenge. But not just on them. It's his revenge on you, Bill.
Which makes me responsible, Hodges thinks bleakly. Except what else could I do? What else could any of us do? He was going to bomb the place. Babineau, going under the name of Myron Zakum, bought 800 of those consoles. It had to be him because he's loaded. Brady was broke, and I doubt Library Al could have fronted even $20,000 from his retirement savings. Those consoles are out there now. And if they all get this amped-up program once they're turned on...
Hold it. Go back, Jerome says. Are you really saying that a respected neurosurgeon got involved in this shit?
That's what I'm saying. Yeah. Your sister ID'd him. And we already know the respected neurosurgeon was using Brady Hartsfield as a lab rat.
But now, Hartsfield's dead, Holly says. Which leaves Babineau, who may also be dead.
Or not, Hodges says. There was blood in his car, but no body. Wouldn't be the first time some doer tried to fake his own death.
I've got to check something on my computer, Holly says. If those three Zappets are getting a new program as of today, then maybe she hurries out.
Jerome begins. I don't understand how any of this can be.
But Babineau will be able to tell us, Hodges says, if he's still alive.
Yes, but wait a minute. Barb talked about hearing a voice, telling her all sorts of awful things. I didn't hear any voice, and I sure don't feel like offing myself.
Maybe you're immune.
I'm not. That screen got me, Bill. I mean, I was gone. I heard words in the little tune, and I think there were words in the blue flashes, too. Like subliminal messages, but no voice.
There could be all sorts of reasons for that, Hodges thinks. And just because Jerome didn't hear the suicide voice, it doesn't mean that most of the kids who got those free games won't. Let's say this repeater gadget was only turned on during the last 14 hours, Hodges says. We know it can't have been earlier than when I tried out Dinah's game, or I would have seen the number fish and the blue flashes. So here's a question. Can those demo screens be amped up even if the gadgets are off?
No way, Jerome says. They have to be turned on. But once they are...
It's active! Holly shouts. That fracking Z, the Insight, is active!
Jerome rushes to her desk in the outer office. Hodges follows more slowly. Holly turns up the volume on her computer, and music fills the offices of Finders Keepers. Not by the beautiful sea this time, but Don't Fear the Reaper. As it spools out, 40,000 men and women every day, another 40,000 coming every day, Hodges sees a candlelit funeral parlor and a coffin buried in flowers. Above it, smiling young men and women come and go, moving side to side, crisscrossing, fading, reappearing. Some of them wave. Some flash the peace sign. Below the coffin is a series of messages in letters that swell and contract like a slowly beating heart. An end to pain. An end to fear. No more anger. No more doubt. No more struggle. Peace. 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 Then a stuttering series of blue flashes. Embedded in them are words, or call them what they really are, Hodges thinks, drops of poison.
Turn it off, Holly.
Hodges doesn't like the way she's looking at the screen, that wide-eyed stare so much like Jerome's a few minutes ago.
She moves too slowly to suit Jerome.
He reaches over her shoulder and crashes her computer.
You shouldn't have done that, she says reproachfully. I could lose data.
That's exactly what the fucking website is for, Jerome says. To make you lose data. To make you lose your shit. I could read the last one, Bill. In the blue flash. It said, do it now. Holly nods.
There was another one that said, tell your friends.
Does the Zap-It direct them to that thing? Hodges asks. It doesn't have to, Jerome says, because the ones who find it, and plenty will, including kids who never got a free Zap-It, will spread the word on Facebook and all the rest.
He wanted a suicide epidemic, Holly says. He set it in motion somehow, then killed himself.
Probably to get there ahead of them, Jerome says, so he can meet them at the door. Hodges says, am I supposed to believe a rock song and a picture of a funeral is going to get kids to kill themselves? The Zap-Its, I can accept that. I've seen how they work. But this? Holly and Jerome exchange a glance, one that Hodges can read easily. How do we explain this to him? How do you explain a robin to someone who's never seen a bird? The glance alone is almost enough to convince him.
Teenagers are vulnerable to stuff like this, Holly says. Not all of them, no, but plenty. I would have been when I was 17.
And it's catching, Jerome says, once it starts. If it starts, he finishes with a shrug. We need to find that repeater gadget and turn it off, Hodges says. Limit the damage.
Maybe it's at Babineau's house, Holly says. Call Pete. Find out if there's any computer stuff there. If there is, make him pull all the plugs.
If he's with Izzy, he'll let it go to voicemail, Hodges says. But he makes the call, and Pete picks up on the first ring. He tells Hodges that Izzy has gone back to the station with the skids to await the first forensics reports. Library Al Brooks is already gone, taken into custody by the first responding cops, who will get partial credit for the bust. Pete sounds tired.
We had a blow-up. Me and Izzy. Big one. I tried to tell her what you told me when we started working together. How the case is the boss and you go where it leads you. No ducking, no handing it off, just pick it up and follow the red thread all the way home. She stood there listening with her arms folded, nodding her head every now and then. I actually thought I was getting through to her. Then you know what she asked me? If I knew the last time there was a woman in the top echelon of the city police. I said I didn't. And she said that was because the answer was never. She said the first one was going to be her.
Man, I thought I knew her. Pete utters what may be the most humorless laugh Hodges has ever heard.
I thought she was police.
Hodges will commiserate later if he gets a chance. Right now there's no time. He asks about the computer gear.
We found nothing except an iPad with a dead battery, Pete says. Everly, the housekeeper, says he had a laptop in his study, almost brand new, but it's gone.
Like Babineau, Hodges says. Maybe it's with him.
Maybe. Remember, if I can help, Kermit...
I'll call, believe me. Right now, he'll take all the help he can get.
21. The result with the girl named Ellen is infuriating, like the Robinson bitch all over again. But at last, Brady calms down. It worked. That's what he needs to focus on. The shortness of the drop combined with the snowbank was just bad luck. There will be plenty of others. He has a lot of work ahead of him, a lot of matches to light. But once the fire is burning, he can sit back and watch. It will burn until it burns itself out. He starts Z-Boy's car and pulls out of the rest area. As he merges with the scant traffic headed north on I-47, the first flakes spin out of the white sky and hit the Malibu's windshield. Brady drives faster. Z-Boy's piece of crap isn't equipped for a snowstorm, and once he leaves the turnpike, the roads will grow progressively worse. He needs to beat the weather.
Oh, I'll beat it all right, Brady thinks, and grins as a wonderful idea hits him. Maybe Ellen is paralyzed from the neck down.
a head on a stick, like the Stover bitch. It's not likely, but it's possible. A pleasant daydream with which to while away the miles. He turns on the radio, finds some Judas Priest, and lets it blast. Like Hodges, he enjoys the hard stuff. The Suicide Prince. Brady won many victories in Room 217, but necessarily had to keep them to himself. Coming back from the living death of coma, discovering that he could, because of the drug Babineau had administered, or because of some fundamental alteration in his brainwaves, or perhaps due to a combination of the two, move small objects simply by thinking about them, inhabiting Library Al's brain, and creating inside him a secondary personality, Z-Boy. And mustn't forget, getting back at the fat cop who hit him in the balls when he couldn't defend himself. Yet, the best, the absolute best, was nudging Sadie McDonald into committing suicide. That was power. He wanted to do it again. The question that desire raised was a simple one. Who next? It would be easy to make Al Brooks jump from a bridge overpass or swallow drain cleaner. But Z-Boy would go with him, and without Z-Boy, Brady would be stuck in Room 217, which was really nothing more than a prison cell with a parking garage view. No, he needed Brooks just where he was, and as he was. More important was the question of what to do about the bastard responsible for putting him here. Ursula Haber, the Nazi who ran the PT department, said rehab patients needed GTG, goals to grow. Well, he was growing, all right. And revenge against Hodges was a worthy goal. But how to get it? Inducing Hodges to commit suicide wasn't the answer, even if there was a way to try it. He'd played the suicide game already with Hodges and lost. When Freddie Linklater appeared with the picture of him and his mother, Brady was still over a year and a half from realizing how he could finish his business with Hodges, but seeing Freddy gave him a badly needed jump start. He would need to be careful, though. Very careful. A step at a time, he told himself as he lay awake in the small hours of the night. Just one step at a time. I have great obstacles, but I also have extraordinary weapons. Step one was having Al Brooks remove the remaining Zappets from the hospital library. He took them to his brother's house, where he lived in an apartment over the garage. That was easy, because no one wanted them anyway. Brady thought of them as ammo. Eventually, he would find a gun that could use it. Brooks took the Zappets on his own, although operating under commands, thought Fish, that Brady implanted in the shallow but useful Z-Boy persona. He had become wary of entering Brooks completely and taking him over because it burned through the old fellow's brains too fast. He had to ration those times of total immersion and use them wisely. It was a shame. He enjoyed his vacations outside the hospital, but people were starting to notice that Library Al had become a trifle foggy upstairs. If he became too foggy, he would be forced out of his volunteer job. Worse, Hodges might notice. That would not be good. Let the old debt-ret vacuum up all the rumors about telekinesis he wanted. Brady was fine with that, but he didn't want Hodges to catch even a whiff of what was really going on. Despite the risk of mental depletion, Brady took complete command of Brooks in the spring of 2013 because he needed the library computer. Looking at it could be done without total immersion, but using it was another thing, and it was a short visit. All he wanted to do was set up a Google alert using the keywords Zappit and Fishin' Hole. Every 2 or 3 days, he sent Z-Boy to check the alert and report back. His instructions were to switch to the ESPN site if someone wandered over to see what he was surfing
They rarely did. The library was really not much more than a closet, and the few visitors were usually looking for the chapel next door. The alerts were interesting and informative. It seemed a great many people had experienced either semi-hypnosis or actual seizure activity after looking at the fish-and-hole demo screen for too long. That effect was more powerful than Brady would have believed. There was even an article about it in the New York Times business section, and the company was in trouble because of it. Trouble it didn't need, because it was already tottering. You didn't have to be a genius, which Brady believed he was, to know that Zappit Inc. would soon either go bankrupt or be swallowed up by a larger company. Brady was betting on bankruptcy. What company would be stupid enough to pick up an outfit making game consoles that were hopelessly out of date and ridiculously expensive, especially when one of the games was dangerously defective? Meanwhile, there was the problem of how to jigger the ones he had. They were stored in the closet of Z-Boy's apartment, but Brady considered them his property, so that people would look at them longer. He was stuck on that when Freddie made her visit. When she was gone, her Christian duty done, not that Frederica Bimmel Linklater was or ever had been a Christian, Brady thought long and hard. Then, in late August of 2013, after a particularly aggravating visit from the debt ret, he sent Z-Boy to her apartment. Freddie counted the money, then studied the old fellow in the green dickie standing slump-shouldered in the middle of what passed for her living room. The money had come from Al Brooks' account at Midwest Federal, the first withdrawal from his meager savings, but far from the last. $200 for a few questions? Yeah, I can do that. But if what you really came for is a blowjob, you need to go somewhere else, old-timer. I'm a dyke. Just questions, Z-Boy said. He handed her a Zappit and told her to look at the fishing hole demo screen. But you shouldn't look longer than 30 seconds or so. It's, weird. Weird, huh? She gave him an indulgent smile and turned her attention to the swimming fish. 30 seconds became 40. That was allowable, according to the directives Brady had given him before sending him on this mission. He always called them missions, having discovered that Brooks associated the word with heroism. But after 45, he grabbed it back. Freddie looked up, blinking.
Whew! It messes with your brain, doesn't it?
Yeah, it kinda does.
I read in Gamer Programming that the Star Smash arcade game does something like that, but you have to play it for, like, half an hour before the effect kicks in. This is a lot faster. Do people know about it?
Z-Boy ignored the question.
My boss wants to know how you would fix this so people would look at the demo screen longer and not go right to the game, which doesn't have the same effect.
Freddie adopted her fake Russian accent for the first time.
Who is fearless leader, Z-Boy? You be a good fellow and tell Comrade X, da?
Z-Boy's brow wrinkled.
Huh?
Freddie sighed. Who's your boss, handsome?
Dr. Z.
Brady had anticipated the question. He knew Freddie of old, and this was another directive. Brady had plans for Felix Babineau, but as yet they were vague. He was still feeling his way, flying on instruments.
Dr. Z and his sidekick Z-Boy, she said, lighting a cigarette. On the path to world domination. My, my. Does that make me Z-Girl?
This wasn't part of his directive, so he stayed silent.
Never mind, I get it, she said, chuffing out smoke. Your boss wants an eye trap. The way to do it is to turn the demo screen itself into a game. Gotta be simple, though. Can't get bogged down in a lot of complex programming.
She held up the Zappit, now turned off.
This thing is pretty brainless.
What kind of game?
Don't ask me, bro. That's the creative side. Never was my forte. Tell your boss to figure it out. Anyway, once this thing is powered up and getting a good Wi-Fi signal, you need to install a rootkit. Want me to write this down?
No.
Brady had allocated a bit of Al Brook's rapidly diminishing memory storage space for this very task. Besides, when the job needed to be done, Freddy would be the one doing it. Once the kit's in, source code can be downloaded from another computer. She adopted the Russian accent again.
From secret base zero under polar ice cap.
Should I tell him that part?
No. Just tell him root kit plus source code. Got it?
Yes.
Anything else?
Brady Hartsfield wants you to come visit him again.
Freddy's eyebrows shot up almost to her crew cut. He talks to you?
Yes. It's hard to understand him at first, but after a while you can.
Freddy looked around her living room, dim, cluttered, smelling of last night's takeout Chinese, as if it interested her. She was finding this conversation increasingly creepy.
I don't know, man. I did my good deed, and I was never even a Girl Scout.
He'll pay you, Z-Boy said. Not very much, but...
How much?
$50 a visit?
Why? Z-Boy didn't know, but in 2013, there was still a fair amount of Al Brooks behind his forehead, and that was the part that understood.
I think because you were a part of his life. You know, when you and him used to go out to fix people's computers. In the old days.
Brady didn't hate Dr. Babineau with the same intensity that he hated K. William Hodges, but that didn't mean Dr. B. wasn't on his shit list. Babineau had used him as a guinea pig, which was bad. He had lost interest in Brady when his experimental drug didn't seem to be working, which was worse. Worst of all, the shots had resumed once Brady had regained consciousness, and who knew what they were doing? They could kill him. But as a man who had assiduously courted his own death, that wasn't what kept him awake nights. What did was the possibility that the shots might interfere with his new abilities. Babineau pooh-poohed Brady's supposed mind-over-matter powers in public, but he actually believed they might exist, even though Brady had been careful never to exhibit his talent to the doctor, despite Babineau's repeated urgings. He believed any psychokinetic abilities were also a result of what he called cerebellum. The CAT scans and MRIs had also resumed. "You're the eighth wonder of the world," Babineau told him after one of these in the fall of 2013, this was. He was walking beside Brady as an orderly wheeled him back to room 217. Babineau was wearing what Brady thought of as his gloaty face.
"The current protocols have done more than halt the destruction of your brain cells. They have stimulated the growth of new ones, more robust ones.
Do you have any idea how remarkable that is?"
"You bet, asshole," Brady thought. "So keep those scans to yourself. If the DA's office found out, I'd be in trouble." Babineau was patting Brady's shoulder in a proprietary way Brady hated, like he was patting his pet dog.
"The human brain is made up of approximately 100 billion nerve cells. Those in the Broca's area of yours were gravely injured, but they have recovered. In fact, they are creating neurons unlike any I've ever seen. One of these days, you're going to be famous, not as a person who took lives, but as one responsible for saving them."
If so, Brady thought, it's a day you won't be around to see. Count on it. Dickweed.
"The creative side never was my forte," Freddy told Z-Boy. True enough, but it was always Brady's, and as 2013 became 2014, he had plenty of time to think of ways the fishing hole demo screen might be juiced up and turned into what Freddy had called an eye trap. Yet none of them seemed quite right. They did not talk about the Zapit effect during her visits. Mostly, they reminisced, with Freddy necessarily doing most of the talking, about the old days on the cyber patrol. All the crazy people they'd met on their outcalls. And Anthony Tones Frobisher, their asshole boss. Freddy went on about him constantly, turning things she should have said into things she had, and right to his face. Freddy's visits were monotonous, but comforting. They balanced his desperate nights, when he felt he might spend the rest of his life in room 217, at the mercy of Dr. Babineau and his vitamin shots. I have to stop him, Brady thought. I have to control him. To do that, the amped-up version of the demo screen had to be just right. If he flubbed his first chance to get into Babineau's mind, there might not be another. The TV now played at least 4 hours a day in room 217. This was per an edict from Babineau, who told head nurse Helmington that he was exposing Mr. Hartsfield to external stimuli. Mr. Hartsfield didn't mind the news at noon. There was always an exciting explosion or a mass tragedy somewhere in the world. But the rest of the stuff, cooking shows, talk shows, soap operas, bogus medicine men, was drivel. Yet one day, while sitting in his chair by the window and watching Prize Surprise, staring in that direction at least, he had a revelation. The contestant, who had survived to the bonus round, was given a chance to win a trip to Aruba on a private jet. She was shown an oversized computer screen where big colored dots were shuffling around. Her job was to touch 5 red ones, which would turn into numbers. If the numbers she touched added up to a total within a 5-digit range of 100, she'd win. Brady watched her wide eyes moving from side to side as she studied the screen, and knew he'd found what he was looking for. The pink fish, he thought. They're the ones that move the fastest. And besides, red is an angry color. Pink is... what? What was the word? It came, and he smiled. It was the radiant one that made him look 19 again. Pink was soothing. Sometimes, when Freddy visited, Z-Boy left his library card in the hall and joined them. On one of these occasions, during the summer of 2014, he handed Freddy an electronic recipe. It had been written on the library computer, and during one of the increasingly rare occasions when Brady did not just give instructions, but slid into the driver's seat and took over completely. He had to, because this had to be just right. There was no room for error. Freddy scanned it, got interested, and read it more closely. "Say," she said, "this is pretty clever. And adding subliminal messaging is cool. Nasty, but cool. Did the mysterious Dr. Z think this up?" "Yeah," Z-Boy said. Freddy switched her attention to Brady. "Do you know who this Dr. Z is?" Brady shook his head slowly back and forth. "Sure it's not you? Because this looks like your work." Brady only stared at her vacantly until she looked away. He had let her see more of him than Hodges or anyone on the nursing or PT staff, but he had no intention of letting her see into him. Not at this point, at least. Too much chance she might talk. Besides, he still didn't know exactly what he was doing. They said that the world would beat a path to your door if you built a better mousetrap, but since he did not as yet know if this one would catch mice, it was best to keep quiet. And Dr. Z didn't exist yet, but he would. On an afternoon not long after Freddy received the electronic recipe explaining just how to jigger the fishing hole demo screen, Z-Boy visited Felix Babineau in his office. The doctor spent an hour there most days he was in the hospital, drinking coffee and reading the newspaper. There was an indoor putting green by the window, no parking garage view for Babineau, where he sometimes practiced his short game. That was where he was when Z-Boy came in without knocking. Babineau looked at him coldly. "Can I help you? Are you lost?" Z-Boy held out Zapit Zero, which Freddy had upgraded after buying several new computer components paid for out of Al Brooks' rapidly shrinking savings account.
"Look at this," he said. "I'll tell you what to do."
"You need to leave," Babineau said. "I don't know what kind of bee you have in your bonnet, but this is my private space and my private time. Or do you want me to call security?"
"Look at it, or you'll be seeing yourself on the evening news. Doctor performs experiments with untested South American drug on accused mass murderer Brady Hartsfield."
Babineau stared at him, with his mouth open. At that moment, looking very much as he would after Brady began to whittle away his core consciousness.
"I have no idea what you're talking about."
"I'm talking about Sarah Bellin. Years away from FDA approval, if ever. I accessed your file and took 24 photos with my phone. I also took photos of the brain scans you've been keeping to yourself. You broke lots of laws, Doc. Look at the game, and it stays between us. Refuse, and your career is over. I'll give you 5 seconds to decide."
Babineau took the game and looked at the swimming fish. The little tune tinkled. Every now and then, there was a flash of blue light.
"Start tapping the pink ones, Doctor. They'll turn into numbers. Add them up in your head."
"How long do I have to do this for?"
"You'll know."
"Are you crazy?"
"You lock your office when you're not here, which is smart, but there are lots of all-access security cards floating around this place, and you left your computer on, which seems kind of crazy to me. Look at the fish. Tap the pink ones. Add up the numbers. That's all you have to do, and I'll leave you alone."
"This is blackmail."
"No, blackmail is for money. This is just a trade. Look at the fish. I won't ask you again."
Babineau looked at the fish. He tapped at a pink one and missed. He tapped again, missed again, muttered "fuck" under his breath. It was quite a bit harder than it looked, and he began to get interested. The blue flashes should have been annoying, but they weren't. They actually seemed to help him focus. Alarm at what this geezer knew started to fade into the background of his thoughts. He succeeded in tapping one of the pink fish before it could shoot off the left side of the screen and got a 9. That was good. A good start. He forgot why he was doing this. Catching the pink fish was the important thing. The tune played. One floor up, in room 217, Brady stared at his own Zap-It and felt his breathing slow. He closed his eyes and looked at a single red dot. That was Z-Boy. He waited, waited, and then, just as he was beginning to think his target might be immune, a second dot appeared. It was faint at first, but gradually grew bright and clear. "Like watching a rose blossom," Brady thought. The two dots began to swim playfully back and forth. He settled his concentration on the one that was Babineau. It slowed and became stationary. "Gotcha," Brady thought. But he had to be careful. This was a stealth mission. The eyes he opened were Babineau's. The doctor was still staring at the fish, but he had ceased to tap them. He had become, what was the word they used? A gork. He had become a gork. Brady did not linger on that first occasion, but it didn't take long to understand the wonders to which he'd gained access. Al Brooks was a piggy bank. Felix Babineau was a vault. Brady had access to his memories, his stored knowledge, his abilities. While in Al, he could have rewired an electrical circuit. In Babineau, he could have performed a craniotomy and rewired a human brain. Further, he had proof of something he had only theorized about and hoped for. He could take possession of others at a distance. All it took was that state of Zap-It-induced hypnosis to open them up. The Zap-It Freddy had modified made for a very efficient eye trap. And good God, it worked so fast. He couldn't wait to use it on Hodges. Before leaving, Brady released a few thought fish into Babineau's brain, but only a few. He intended to move very carefully with the doctor. Babineau needed to be thoroughly habituated to the screen, which was now what those specializing in hypnosis called an inducement device, before Brady announced himself. One of that day's thought fish was the idea that the CAT scans on Brady weren't producing anything of real interest and ought to cease. The cerebellum shots should also cease. Because Brady's not making sufficient progress. Because I'm a dead end. Also, I might be caught. Getting caught would be bad, Babineau murmured.
Yes, Z-Boy said. Getting caught would be bad for both of us.
Babineau had dropped his putter. Z-Boy picked it up and put it in his hand. As that hot summer morphed into a cold and rainy fall, Brady strengthened his hold on Babineau. He released thought fish carefully, like a game warden stocking a pond with trout. Babineau began to feel an urge to get touchy-feely with a few of the younger nurses risking a sexual harassment complaint. Babineau occasionally stole pain medication from the bucket's Pyxis med station using the ID card of a fictional doctor, a fiddle Brady set up via Freddie Linkletter. Babineau did this even though he was bound to be caught if he kept on and had other safer ways of getting pills. He stole a Rolex watch from the Neuro Lounge one day, although he had one of his own, and put it in the bottom drawer of his office desk where he promptly forgot it. Little by little, Brady Hartsfield, who could barely walk, took possession of the doctor who had presumed to take possession of him and put him in a guilt trap that had many teeth. If he did something foolish, like trying to tell someone what was going on, the trap would snap shut. At the same time, he began sculpting the Dr. Z personality, doing it much more carefully than he had with Library Al. For one thing, he was better at it now. For another, he had finer materials to work with. In October of that year, with hundreds of thought fish now swimming in Babineau's brain, he began assuming control of the doctor's body as well as his mind, taking it on longer and longer trips. Once, he drove all the way to the Ohio state line in Babineau's BMW, just to see if his hold would weaken with distance. It didn't. It seemed that once you were in. And it was a fine trip. He stopped at a roadside restaurant and pigged out on onion rings. Tasty! As the 2014 holiday season approached, Brady found himself in a state he hadn't known since earliest childhood. It was so foreign to him that the Christmas decorations had been taken down and Valentine's Day was approaching before he realized what it was. He felt contented. Part of him fought this feeling, labeling it a little death, but part of him wanted to accept it, embrace it, even. And why not? It wasn't as though he were stuck in room 217 or even in his own body. He could leave whenever he wanted, either as a passenger or as a driver. He had to be careful not to be in the driver's seat too much or stay too long, that was all. Core consciousness, it seemed, was a limited resource. When it was gone, it was gone. Too bad. If Hodges had continued to make his visits, Brady would have had another of those goals to grow, getting him to look at the Zap-It in his drawer, entering him and planting suicidal thought fish. It would have been like using Debbie's blue umbrella all over again, only this time with suggestions that were much more powerful. Not really suggestions at all, but commands. The only problem with the plan was that Hodges had stopped coming. He had appeared just after Labor Day
spouting all his usual bullshit. I know you're in there, Brady. I hope you're suffering, Brady. Can you really move things around without touching them, Brady? If you can, let me see you do it. But not since. Brady surmised that Hodge's disappearance from his life was the real source of this unusual and not entirely welcome contentment. Hodges had been a burr under his saddle, infuriating him and making him gallop. Now the burr was gone, and he was free to graze if he wanted to. He sort of did. With access to Dr. Babineau's bank account and investment portfolio, as well as his mind, Brady went on a computer spending spree. The Babster withdrew the money and made the purchases. Z-Boy delivered the equipment to Freddie Linklater's cheese dog of a crib. She really deserves an apartment upgrade, Brady thought. I ought to do something about that. Z-Boy also brought her the rest of the Zappets he'd pilfered from the library, and Freddie amped the fishing hole demos in all of them. For a price, of course. And although the price was high, Brady paid it without a qualm. It was the doc's money, after all. The dough of Babineau. As to what he might do with the juiced-up consoles, Brady had no idea. Eventually, he might want another drone or two, he supposed, but he saw no reason to trade up right away. He began to understand what contentment actually was, the emotional version of the horse latitudes, where all the winds died away and one simply drifted. It ensued when one ran out of goals to grow. This state of affairs continued until February 13th of 2015, when Brady's attention was caught by an item on News at Noon. The anchors, who had been laughing it up over the antics of a couple of baby pandas, put on their "oh shit, this is so awful" faces when the chyron behind them changed from the pandas to a broken heart logo. "It's going to be a sad Valentine's Day in the suburb of Swickley," said the female half of the duo. "That's right, Betty," said the male half. "Two survivors of the city center massacre, 26-year-old Krista Countryman and 24-year-old Keith Frias, have committed suicide in the Countryman woman's home." It was Betty's turn. "Ken, the shocked parents say the couple was hoping to be married in May of this year, but both were badly injured in the attack perpetrated by Brady Hartsfield, and the continuing physical and mental pain was apparently too much for them. Here's Frank Denton with more." Brady was on high alert now, sitting as close to bolt upright in his chair as he could manage, eyes shining. Could he legitimately claim those two? He believed he could, which meant his city center score had just gone up from 8 to 10. Still shy of a dozen, but hey, not bad. Correspondent Frank Denton, also wearing his best "oh shit" expression, went blah-de-blah for a while, and then the picture switched to the Countryman chick's poor old daddy, who read the suicide note the couple had left. He blubbered through most of it, but Brady caught the gist. They'd had a beautiful vision of the afterlife, where their wounds would be healed, the burden of their pain would be lifted, and they could be married in perfect health by their Lord and Savior Jesus Christ. "Boy, that's sad," the male anchor opined at the end of the story. "So sad." "It sure is, Ken," Betty said. Then the screen behind them flashed a picture showing a bunch of idiots in wedding clothes standing in a swimming pool, and her sad face clicked off, and the happy one came back on. "But this should cheer you up. 20 couples decided to get married in a swimming pool in Cleveland, where it's only 20 degrees.
I hope they had a hunk of burning love," Ken said, showing his perfectly capped teeth in a grin. "Brrr. There's Patty Newfield with the details."
How many more could I get? Brady wondered. He was on fire. "I've got 9 augmented Zappets plus the 2 my drones have and the 1 in my drawer. Who says I have to be done with those job-hunting assholes? Who says I can't run up the score?" Brady
continued to keep track of Zapit Inc. during his fallow period, sending Z-Boy to check the Google alert once or twice weekly. The chatter about the hypnotic effect of the fishing hole screen and the lesser effect of the whistling birds demo died down and was replaced by speculation about just when the company would go under. It was no longer a matter of if. When Sunrise Solutions bought Zapit out, a blogger who called himself Electric Whirlwind wrote, "Wow, this is like a couple of cancer patients with 6 weeks to live deciding to elope." Babineau's shadow personality was now well established, and it was Dr. Z who began to research the survivors of the city center massacre on Brady's behalf, making a list of the ones most badly injured, and thus most vulnerable to suicidal thoughts. A couple of them, like Daniel Starr and Judith Loma, were still wheelchair-bound. Loma might get out of hers, Starr never. Then there was Martine Stover, paralyzed from the neck down and living with her mother over in Ridgedale. I'd be doing them a favor, Brady thought. Really, I would. He decided Stover's mommy would make a good start. His first idea was to have Z-Boy mail her a Zapit, a free gift for you. But how could he be sure she wouldn't just throw it away? He only had 9 and didn't want to risk wasting one. Juicing them up had cost him, well, Babineau, quite a lot of money. It might be better to send Babineau on a personal mission. In one of his tailored suits, set off by a sober dark tie, he looked a lot more trustworthy than Z-Boy in his rumpled green dickies, and he was the sort of older guy that chicks like Stover's mother had a tendency to dig. All Brady had to do was work up a believable story. Something about test marketing, maybe? Possibly a book club? A prize competition? He was still sifting scenarios, and there was no hurry, when his Google alert announced an expected death. Sunrise Solutions had gone bye-bye. This was in early April. A trustee had been appointed to sell off the assets, and a list of so-called real goods would soon appear in the usual sell sites. For those who couldn't wait, a list of all Sunrise Solutions' unsaleable crapola could be found in the bankruptcy filing. Brady thought this was interesting, but not interesting enough to have Dr. Z look up the list of assets. There were probably crates of Zapits among them, but he had 9 of his own, and surely that would be enough to play with. A month later, he changed his mind about that. One of News at Noon's most popular features was called Just a Word from Jack. Jack O'Malley was a fat old dinosaur who had probably started in the biz when TV was still black and white, and he bumbled on for 5 minutes or so at the end of every newscast about whatever was on what remained of his mind. He wore huge black-rimmed glasses, and his jowls quivered like jello when he talked. Ordinarily, Brady found him quite entertaining, a bit of comic relief, but there was nothing amusing about that day's word from Jack. It opened whole new vistas.
The families of Krista Countryman and Keith Frias have been flooded with condolences as a result of a story the station ran not long ago,
Jack said in his grouchy Andy Rooney voice.
Their decision to terminate their lives when they could no longer live with unending and unmitigated pain has reignited the debate on the ethics of suicide. It also reminded us, unfortunately, of the coward who caused that unending, unmitigated pain. A monster named Brady Wilson Hartsfield.
That's me, Brady thought happily. When they even give your middle name, you know you're an authentic boogeyman.
If there is a life after this one, Jack said, out of control, Andy Rooney brows drawing together, jowls flapping. Brady Wilson Hartsfield will pay the full price for his crimes when he gets there. In the meantime, let us consider the silver lining in this dark cloud of woe, because there really is one. A year after his cowardly killing spree at City Center, Brady Wilson Hartsfield attempted an even more heinous crime. he smuggled a large quantity of plastic explosive into a concert at Mingo Auditorium, with the intent to murder thousands of teens who were there to have a good time. In this, he was thwarted by retired detective William Hodges and a brave woman named Holly Gibney, who smashed the homicidal loser's skull before he could detonate.
Here, Brady lost the thread. Some woman named Holly Gibney had been the one to smash him in the head and almost kill him? Who the fuck was Holly Gibney? And why had no one ever told him this in the 5 years since she'd turned his lights out and landed him in this room? How was that possible? Very easily, he decided. When the coverage was fresh, he'd been in a coma. Later on, he thought, I just assumed it was either Hodges or his nigger lawn boy. He would look Gibney up on the web when he got a chance, but she wasn't the important thing. She was part of the past. The future was a splendid idea that had come to him as his best inventions always had, whole and complete, needing only a few modifications along the way to make it perfect. He powered up his Zap-It, found Z-Boy, currently handing out magazines to patients waiting in OBGYN, and sent him to the library computer. Once he was seated in front of the screen, Brady shoved him out of the driver's seat and took control, hunched over and squinting at the monitor with Al Brooks' nearsighted eyes. On a website called Bankruptcy Assets 2015, he found the list of all the stuff Sunrise Solutions had left behind. There was junk from a dozen different companies listed alphabetically. Zap-It was the last, but as far as Brady was concerned, far from least. Heading the list of their assets was 45,872 Zap-It Commanders, suggested retail price $189.99. They were being sold in lots of 400, 800, and 1,000. Below, in red, was the caveat that part of the shipment was defective, but most are in perfect working condition. Brady's excitement had Library Al's old heart laboring. His hands left the keyboard and curled into fists. Getting more of the city center survivors to commit suicide paled in comparison to the grand idea that now possessed him, finishing what he had tried to do that night at the Mingo. He could see himself writing to Hodges from beneath the blue umbrella, "You think you stopped me? Think again." How wonderful that would be. He was pretty sure Babineau had more than enough money to buy a Zap-It console for everyone who had been there that night, but since Brady would have to handle his targets one at a time, it wouldn't do to go overboard. He had Z-Boy bring Babineau to him. Babineau didn't want to come. He was afraid of Brady now, which Brady found delicious. "You're going to be buying some goods," Brady said. "Buying some goods." Docile, no longer afraid. Babineau had entered room 217, but it was now Dr. Z standing slump-shouldered in front of Brady's chair. "Yes, you'll want to put money in a new account. I think we'll call it Games Unlimited. That's Games with a Z." "With a Z, like me." The head of the Kiner Neurology Department managed a small, vacuous smile. "Very good. Let's say $150,000. You'll also be setting Freddie Linklater up in a new and bigger apartment, so she can receive the goods you buy, and then work on them. She's going to be a busy girl."
"I'll be setting her up in a new and bigger apartment, so..."
"Just shut up and listen. She'll be needing some more equipment, too." Brady leaned forward. He could see a bright future ahead, one where Brady Wilson Hartsfield was crowned the winner years after the debt ret thought the game had ended. The most important piece of equipment is called a repeater.